A few weeks ago, Dr. Presley addressed a forum on the upswing of American Buddhism and import of Tibetan Buddhism from Asia to the West. And I hope you were able to attend. I requested his notes on how Buddhism looks Hollywood style. For about 5 years, I've been researching Tibetan Buddhism in its natural habitat. And wow, what a contrast from the Hollywood version. Lynn's daughter, Karis, and I went to Tibet last summer to confirm the horrible hidden truths behind the squeaky, clean, well-marketed version that we're shown in Hollywood. In a nutshell, Tibetan Buddhism, in its natural state, as it has been practiced for centuries, is atheistic, black magic, sex magic, demon worship, filled with foul, disgusting rituals, the use of human skulls, bones, and skin, and demon-invoking ceremonies, secret rites with the drinking of menstrual blood and semen, possessed monks as spiritual advisors, and a prophecy predicting the genocide of the seed of Abraham, all Muslims, Christians, and Jews, in order for a global Buddhocracy to be established. And for the Tibetans, the simple country folk who've been isolated for centuries, Tibetan Buddhism is a life of futile, exhausting, graceless appeasement. There is no grace. There is no forgiveness of sin, ever. Just through countless lifetimes, they believe they must keep working, working, working. There is no creator God, no Jesus. Picture's worth a thousand words. So here is a ritual vessel from the Potala Palace. It's a skull bowl that has significant black magic power. They say that a skull of a child of incest has more power than this old llama. There is also a photo that Karis took when we were in Tibet. We were touring the monasteries, which is the only kind of tour you pretty much can have. And our tour guide said, oh, we are so lucky, you get to see the mass dance. We happened upon a ritual called the mass dance. And in this dance, the monks gather around. They have very ornate robes. They put on these masks that are fanged, bulgy-eyed creatures. And as the trumpets begin to blow, that Tibetan blaring, and the clanging of the cymbals, they begin to dance in a circle in a very kind of menacing style. In the middle of the circle is a mat, and on that mat has been painted a drawing of a flayed, disemboweled human being. And on that mat is an effigy, a dummy, a stuffed dummy of a human. And what is put in the belly looked like human intestines. As the ritual proceeds, this head monk begins to take these human entrails and hurl them in the direction of the circling monks. And one of the monks caught a hunk of it on his fang. I'm sorry you guys are eating pizza. I'm sorry. You should have told me. But anyway, you know, he catches a hunk of this stuff and is swinging it around, and the crowd's going ooh and ah. Wow. I've acquired other pictures of skulls engraved with Buddhas and perverse images. They're all up here if you want to see them. They're really creepy. It's quite a different picture than you get of the Nobel Peace Prize winning Dalai Lama, the gentle monk who got a Congressional Medal of Honor and all of his rich and famous devotees. However it is taught in the East or in the West, Tibetan Buddhism is still atheistic demon worship. And demon-invoking ceremonies are occurring now in our museums, libraries, colleges, even in churches in America. Lynn and I have been stunned to see how pagan religions are morphing into other shapes in order to make them more palatable here in the West.
If you want her notes on Tibet, you can make a note to email and ask for that document. She used the word morphing. Different religions morphing. That's a very good way to describe it. There's a jumbling of categories, religious categories, and there's a jumbling of terminology. So I just want to touch on those two things. If you go into the bookstore, into the religion section, I really don't know how the clerks know where to stack the books, because a book in one section is often heavily referencing a book that belongs in another category. And I brought this book as really a classic example of what I'm talking about. This book is called The Wisdom to Know the Difference, when to make a change, when to let go, the inside flap, the author draws on her Quaker faith, as well as other spiritual traditions, blah, 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 and listening to our own inner voice. So there is Christianity, world religions, and New Age. Front cover endorsement, the Dalai Lama. Back cover endorsement, Christian writer Phyllis Tickle. Where do you shelve this book? That's exactly the problem and why people are being confused. And even in the Christian bookstore, there are books that heavily rely on other religious systems. So in the religion section at Borders, for example, Leonard Sweet's book would be in the Christian section, but he credits his spirituality to Ken Wilber, and Ken Wilber's books are in the metaphysical section. And if you go to Ken Wilber's Life Grid, if you request the quiz, there's a link to that. You find this black magic, sex magic, and Zen, and serpent power, Kundalini yoga. So where should this book be? So there's a confusion of belief systems. Then there's a confusion of terminology. There are words that we as Christians, we know what they mean. We know what they mean. Christ, atonement, resurrection, kingdom, reconciliation. But in some of the new books, even books in Christian bookstores, these words have been given new definitions. We just didn't get the memo. So we are reading those through a filter of our own definitions of those things, but that's not what the writers mean. And if there's only one thing you remember of what I say today, that should be it. Different definitions have been assigned, and we need to find out what those definitions are. If we read something openly alarming, like about the Buddha nature within, then our antenna would be up. But those terms aren't being used so much. It's terms that sound like words. We know what they mean. There are terms that seem neutral. The silence, creative imagination, ecstasy. In your mind, you click with a definition of what you think that is. They mean something else, and you need to find out what it is. There are terms that seem Christian but maybe new to some of us. Terms like ancient Christian practice, interspirituality, spiritual formation, and by dictionary definitions, we think we know what they're talking about, but they may not be. One example, a good example, is Christ follower. That term has at least three definitions. If I say it, I'm just using it interchangeably with the word Christian. I'm a Christ follower. I'm committed to Jesus. The interspiritualists, that's people who are blending and taking from all the world's religions, and interspirituality is becoming more and more popular. They mean, I follow Christ, I follow Buddha, I follow several things of several persuasions. So Christ follower doesn't mean what I mean by it. The third meaning, here's a quote, the church has hindered and not helped but in its fanatical zeal to make people Christians instead of Christ followers. Does that sound like anything you've heard recently? It sounds just like Brian McLaren, but Brian McLaren didn't say that. That quote is actually from occultist Alice Bailey, who is channeling a demon, and it doesn't mean Jesus Christ at all. It means the coming cosmic Christ, Lord Maitreya. So here's a demon voice saying, the church is hindering because it's not turning people into Christ followers. Why would the church turn people into cosmic Christ followers? Well, that's the plan, for the church to help do that. So we need to know the terminology. Another term that's being terrifically confused today is contemplative prayer.
Contemplative prayer is neither contemplative thinking nor prayer, talking to God. So it isn't what it says it is. That's kind of confusing. If you're not familiar with this practice, it was introduced to the church through Thomas Keating, Basil Pennington, and Thomas Merton. And as per their instructions, you choose a sacred word or phrase, go by yourself, sit comfortably, and with your eyes closed, you begin measured breathing in and out. And you repeat your word or phrase over and over again to empty your mind. When you become aware of thoughts, they say, return ever so gently to the sacred word. Don't change the word during the prayer, for that would be to start thinking again. The desired result is a direct experience of God, sometimes called union with the divine. Do this for 20 minutes, twice a day. But there are some problems. Physical side effects. They tell us that praying before going to bed may disturb one's sleep pattern. Other symptoms they include slight pains, itches, or twitches in various parts of the body, heaviness or lightness in the extremities. Some sites say this is the work of the Holy Spirit. Others mention frightening sensations of burning, suffocation, debilitating confusion. That's a problem. Second problem, what Christian experts on pagan mysticism say about contemplative prayer. A few years ago, as we were beginning to investigate this and go, like, what's going on? We approached a missionary to Hindus, a Japanese minister to Buddhists, and a missionary to Satanists. And we said, there's a new kind of prayer being taught in the churches. It's called contemplative prayer. Have you ever heard of it? And they hadn't. We said, well, we described it as I've just described it. You sit quietly, you breathe in, breathe out. Say a phrase over and over, emptying your mind of thought. The missionary to the Hindus said, well, that's Hindu. The minister to the Buddhist said, that's Buddhist. And the missionary to Satan said, that's a cult. The third problem is just plain common sense says it's a problem. Prayer, according to the scriptures, is so simple. God made it simple for the simplest child to the most uneducated, to the most educated person. You come before the creator of the universe and you talk to him like you would a loved one. So imagine your mom or a roommate or your spouse coming home and they say, how was your day? 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 For 20 minutes. How was your day? Stop me when this gets annoying. How was your day?
About 3 minutes ago. Day?
How does that enhance a relationship? What must God be thinking when we're sitting saying, Maranatha, 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 for 20 minutes trying to empty our mind of all thought? Third problem, what Richard Foster says about contemplative prayer. In his book on prayer, he has a whole chapter devoted to and describes it as wordless, that is, thoughtless. It is a prayer that is thoughtless, and Dr. Cottrell says a prayer with no content, a contentless prayer. He also mentions in the beginning paragraphs that we need to get over our addiction to words. Now, it took me a couple of readings of this chapter to get it, because he is a great writer. He's very engaging, very intelligent. Addiction to words. Wait a minute. I'm reading a book full of words. When you go to church, what do? You pray, you sing, you listen to the sermon, you teach, read the Bible, all words. All words. God used words to create the universe. Foster also said that it is not for a novice. This kind of prayer is not for the novice. That means it's exclusive. You can do it, but I can't. I'm a new Christian. Wow. There's an exclusive kind of prayer? It's also unmediated. Now, he doesn't explain what this means, but I only know of two kinds of mediated prayer. One is the Old Testament kind where the priest mediates, and the New Testament Christ where Jesus, our high priest, mediates for us. So what is unmediated? And he also said it's spiritually dangerous, which leads us to the fifth problem. Thomas Merton elaborates the dangers in his whole book on contemplative prayer. One review of this book says that in contemplative prayer, the Christian attempts to devoid himself of all of his thoughts and feelings so that God can come directly to him. God can't come directly to us unless we empty our minds. He goes on, while this result is great indeed, there are also horrible dangers associated with contemplative prayer. The Christian may be contacted by a demon, might lose his faith, might experience intense dread as he believes that God has abandoned him, or he could fool himself into thinking that God came to him when he actually created the thoughts and feelings himself and achieves a false sense of his own beliefs. And this is what the experts, those who wrote the books and coined the term, say that it is. And many of our Catholic and Protestant brothers and sisters in Christ have already adopted wordless, exclusive, unmediated, dangerous meditation. The books are selling, the websites are up, the Buddhist Christian dialogues are agreeing, the retreat centers are open, the lecturers are on the circuit, and they're calling it contemplative prayer, even though it's neither contemplating, thinking, or prayer, talking to God. Biblical prayer and meditation are entirely relational. We talk, we think, we listen, we wonder about God. The mind is intensely active, engaged with the things of God, says Admiral Unger. His works, himself, we are thinking about him. Legitimate so-called mystical experiences, the experiences of those in the lives of the prophets, are initiated by God as he wills and for his purpose. It isn't a spiritual technology that you cultivate and you're in charge. Most Christians I have ever talked to testify of God working directly in their lives without the benefit of this occult tool. We're not missing anything, people. I'm stumped as to why a believer thinks he needs a Hindu type of union with God when the Spirit already dwells in us. Jesus is ever mediating for us. The Father always cares and provides for us. We have been promised consummate union, but at a future time, and not singularly, but in a community as part of the Bride of Christ. And we know that his divine power has given us everything we need for life and godliness through our knowledge of him who calls us.
Is it really possible that the church would adopt practices that are as far off as this sounds? Well, there may be several ways that this could happen, and I already touched on it a little bit about the confusion of belief systems and the confusion of terminology. Then if respected Christian teachers are bringing these teachings in, that's one way it could be accepted directly. Another way is just by things that happen in the secular community. We're all influenced by peer pressure. So the church was already primed in a way to accept something that sounds like meditation or sounds like Zen because the community has Zen classes and meditation classes. And these are often billed as neutral. It's not religious. Business people go to such things to help focus or to relieve stress. So it's just another step then to have Christian Zen. I talked to the Zen master at the Methodist Church in College Hill, and he considers himself a good Methodist and a Zen master. Nice guy. We had a great conversation. And he thought he was helping me by saying, well, you know, Zen is not limited to Buddhism. If a Christian and a Buddhist and an atheist were all in a room together and they all did Zen, they would all have exactly the same experience. And I said, well, I know that's my complaint. That's my complaint. Christians aren't supposed to adopt the practices of pagan religions and worship God in the same way that they do. And I asked him, are you equating this experience with what's being called contemplative prayer in the churches? And he said, yes. And he said, I think you'll find it's being accepted in churches all across the country. There's visualization that sounds like just a neutral practice, but when you are conjuring up an entity to speak to you, that's occult visualization, and that comes into the church in the form of some of this healing of memories where you relive the painful incident and you bring Jesus there and then you have him say something to you. This is an occult practice. There's yoga, community practice, you know, community sessions of yoga that are billed either as neutral or playing on the sort of exotic spirituality factor, because we're all attracted to this, just like, you know, as the last forum when you looked at the Hollywood version of things like this. So then it's just another step, if Christians already are participating in this, to have Christian yoga in the church. Many Christians will argue that yoga is not Hindu, but the Hindus say it is. This is just another step. We keep taking a step, another step away. This opens the door to other darker religious practices. That one of our churches in Tulsa has had Hindu weddings inside their worship center. This is an attempt at community outreach, but Hindu weddings invoke Hindu gods into the Lord's sanctuary. Don't take my word for this. Walk the halls of your church. Ask the people in your church. What are they reading? What kind of objects do they have in their home? What are they believing? Where are they getting their spirituality? Do they have the wisdom to know the difference in the good and the bad? Things at school, children are being taken through activities that are called relaxation techniques or things that quiet the children, but they are taken from things like yoga and mantra meditation. One five-year-old came home from school having been through one of these things that's called brain gym, a five-year-old, and said, "Mommy, a voice in my head told me to hate God." This is not a neutral exercise. But because our friends in the community tell us, "Oh, it's not religious," we accept it. Of course, the main thing going on here is that Christians don't know the Bible. If we know the truth, we recognize the false. That's the number one thing. And all these other things about confusion are secondary to that. Reiki. Anybody know about Reiki? Massage therapists are learning to become Reiki practitioners. This is Jenna calls it faith healing without Jesus. You are channeling a spirit energy to apply to the patient. Our hospitals in the city have notices about this on their bulletin boards. And again, it's either billed as not religious or a neutral practice. And you should be warned, this could be done, performed on you even without your knowledge. We know of that happening. People in the church are reading The Secret as a spiritual study, not to critique it. Don't kid yourself to thinking they know better. I talked to a longtime Christian and said, "Do you realize this is a channeled work?" "Oh, is that wrong?" The Tibetan Buddhist monks are doing sand mandala ceremonies. That's the art on the front of the poster for today's session. Tibetan Buddhist ceremony. It's religious, even though the newspapers bill it as a cultural exchange. They've been performed at Northern, at the library across the river, Columbus. They're often performed near a river. In the creation of this beautiful sand, a house for the gods, the deities are invoked to come in. Then the sand is broken up, sprinkled on the bystanders. Some of it is sprinkled in the river to carry away, and some of it's placed in a jar and buried on the site. The land has been dedicated to a demon. Just sounds right out of the Old Testament. These ceremonies are being performed in churches, and not just churches on the far end of the weird scale. These are being performed in churches all across the country. And then we take up a collection for the Buddhist monks who perform this, and the money goes to their monasteries in India. So Christians are funding the spread of the Tibetan Buddhism you just heard described. The community talks about sacred space. We like feng shui, sacred space, sacred objects. And see, so we're primed to accept the idea of sacred space, sacred objects. I went to the Presbyterian Church up in, I don't know if it's Forest Park, because they had brought in a labyrinth. This is a sacred space. And I said, "Well, what do I do?" "Well, we'll give you a sacred object." It was a little church or a cross. "And we'll tell you a sacred word. And then you walk the labyrinth." "Well, I don't really understand. What's supposed to happen?" "Well, say you need to be forgiven. You just say, you hold the object, you say the secret word over and over, and you can walk in and out of the labyrinth as many times as you need until you feel forgiven." Are you catching a pattern about experience over truth? It's all about experience. I could go on and on. Asia is cool. Asia is cool. And so we're open to anything from Asia. And I love Asia myself, but I don't need my religious instruction from Buddhism. J. Henry, native of India, longtime minister there, said he was appalled at the number of Christians who have little Buddhas or little Hindu gods in their houses as decoration. These are detestable things. The Catholic Basilica across the river houses a statue of Buddha. I could go on and on. I have a whole list if you want to see them afterwards, but I'm trying to make the connection between our acceptance of things in the community brings it in to individual Christian practice and into the church. The Dalai Lama, a couple years ago, had an event in Seattle called Seeds of Compassion. If you want the letter I wrote about that, make a note to ask for that. Seeds of Compassion. Like Tibetan Buddhism knows anything about compassion. People brought their children and had the Dalai Lama put his hands on them for a blessing. Has anybody ever heard of occult transference? Take Dr. Cottrell to lunch someday. Emergent church ministers Rob Bell and Doug Padgett participated in this event. They joined forces with this event. Jenna watched all the video footage she could find, and they never once seemed to make any kind of statement for Jesus. Rob Bell called the Dalai Lama, "Your Holiness," and Doug Padgett, before the event, posted the lotus symbol on his own church's website. The lotus symbol is to Eastern religions what the cross is to Christianity. Buddha sits on a lotus. It's a detestable thing. I know it's just a flower, but in this context, it has become a symbol of that. If Christian ministers are promoting these things, that's how it gets into the church. Don't think your church people are okay. They're not. And we need to be aware of what's happening and what's coming in. These are the leaders of the churches. You have terrific influence. And so we have a heavy responsibility. It's so funny that we're here. As R.C. Foster said when he dedicated this building, and his speech is upstairs in the library, we're on a battlefield. I thought he was overstating things. I was young and foolish. He's right on.
Okay, if you want to do some research on contemplative prayer, and I know we keep coming back to this, but that spiritual technology, if you will, the 20 minutes, the breathing in and out, the mantra, that ritual is central to every form of pagan mysticism I could find. I began to find this commonality and started making myself a chart, you know, and it's in Sufism, which is Islamic mysticism. It's in several forms of Buddhism. It's in Hinduism. It's in, you know, New Age, occult. If you want to go down that bizarre path, contacting aliens, they do the same thing, to contact aliens from other planets. It's same ritual, and for centuries, for millennia. Why is it done? It works. I think it works. But it's not Jesus they're contacting. Anyway, so a quick family tree or a family ladder, if you will. Richard Foster's chapter on contemplative prayer, where did he learn it? We go back to Merton, Pennington, and Keating. Let's go across the ladder. Where did they learn that? They will tell you. Zen masters, Hindu yogis, and the Dalai Lama, who is the god king of black magic, sex magic, Buddhism. Going back to the Middle Ages, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, John of the Cross. Be careful when you read, and read from several perspectives. Okay, while marketed as sacrificial devotion, you will find, if you get into the psychological aspects of it, just extremes, disturbing extremes in asceticism, self-abuse, self-starvation, feeding, drinking the pus of lepers. I'm sorry, you're eating pizza. Hours in frozen trance states, ecstasies described in erotic terms. Teresa's closest friends feared that she was possessed. Look at this in light of scripture, and you'll find in this kind of meditative practice a useless, self-destructive, extreme kind of legalism. And you go on back to 500 AD to pseudo-Dionysius, an anonymous writer, some think he was a Syrian monk, who used the name of the apostle's friend from the book of Acts to give credibility to his teaching. And he introduced this phrase, the divine darkness, pseudo-Dionysius, because he was a false Dionysius. We go back to the Desert Fathers. Thomas Merton felt that the Desert Fathers' meditation practices were so similar to Buddhist meditation practices that they must have learned from the Buddhists. If not that, then that's teaching that knowledge spontaneously arose. Go back to Gnosticism. You can read commentaries on the Book of Colossians, the Gnostic heresy, and on back to Buddhism. Buddhism sprang out as a rebellion against Hinduism. And in Hinduism, the use of breath meditation to access the higher self, capital S, which is the universe, which is you, goes at least back to the Hindu scriptures called the Upanishads in 650 BC. And then there's some sketchy stuff all the way back to Egypt. So back to the top, Thomas Merton is the linchpin of this mystical movement among our brothers and sisters. I was a Merton fan. I thought he's a brilliant writer, he's engaging, his words are wonderful, he's poetic, until I got into his later books and saw his terrible trajectory for what he calls the darkness and the void, and quoting him, going beyond God, that he wanted to go out and get lost in it.
Jenna has a couple of pages of Thomas Merton quotes. If you would like those, make a note to request that. We've begun to discover that there are symptoms or side effects that kind of follow anybody who's doing this contemplative prayer. And, I mean, we've been looking at this for about 6 years. The emergent church people, the big names in the emergent church are also promote this. And so you have emergent theology and contemplative theology. That's not to say that everybody who uses the name emergent, some people just want to sound cool because that's the new thing. And so they may be solid, they're just using that term, but see, that confuses things. The emergent theologians and the contemplative theologians have side effects, have symptoms, things you can begin to put your finger on. And I can send you this whole list if you want, the side effects of contemplative prayer. But this may play out in people of other religions. If somebody's already a Buddhist and he's doing this, on the one level, everybody has the same experience of feeling light and peace, you know, this initial experience. On a deeper level, for Christians, to get you away from Christianity, you've got to develop an aversion to the scriptures. You've got to dismiss the atonement. And so that's what's happening in Christians who are practicing this. So a walk away from absolute truth and the scriptures and more about experience, and then a downplaying of the atonement or even an outright mockery of the atonement. For example, Alan Jones, Reimagining Christianity, there's that word, imagine. The church's fixation on the death of Jesus as the universal saving act must end. Why? Because of the cult of suffering and the vindictive God behind it. Okay, so you have to get rid of the atonement. You have to get down Bible truth. The book of Isaiah can't be a real account. It has to just be poetic imagination, you know, because Isaiah 53 is dripping with substitutionary atonement. So if you got to get Jesus down, you got to get rid of that. These are some of the things that are happening. A hate the church attitude, or the church isn't doing anything and probably never has. That's part of it. A mixing of sexual wordage or sexual practice with worship. Erotic worship, Tony Campolo. And jumbled writing that sounds more like the Zen masters than the usual Christian writing, jumbled writing. There's a whole list of these things. But this is a trajectory, while the intention may have been to go toward God, it ends up going away from God.
Now, I was just a music major, and we kind of don't know anything about theology, but I did have to take some Bible classes way back in the Dark Ages, and we learned something, you know, it was called Heilsgeschichte, historical criticism, Formgeschichte. Mm-hmm. We had to use the German word for some reason. Well, Lynn kind of coined a phrase to describe this theology that she just has been describing, and we call it Bullgeschichte.
I didn't know she was going to say that.
Okay. This forum was on mysticism and the church, and true, we have leaned heavily toward the Buddhist side of the subject because this is our area of expertise. But also, it's been said that Buddhism shrink wraps other religions. And we're seeing this happen here. Buddhism shrink wraps other religions. This was a post on a Buddhist blog. And if you read this Screwtape Letters, this is C.S. Lewis's fictional correspondence between a senior devil and his student, then the tone of this Buddhist blog, the tone of this correspondence might be kind of eerily familiar. The heading of the blog was Converting Christianity to Buddhism. Here's a few excerpts. American Christianity, the mainstream spirituality of this culture, can receive some cross-fertilization from the best of Buddhist tradition while being encouraged to bring out the best within itself. Maybe even some stuff that has been neglected or forgotten, like the contemplative tradition of Pseudo-Dionysius or the social conscience of Thomas Merton. Right? See what we're saying? This guy is trying to convert Christianity to Buddhism and suggests to his student that he introduce the teachings of Pseudo-Dionysius or Thomas Merton. What we need is for Buddhist ideas to penetrate the hearts and minds of people outside of formerly Buddhist countries. For that to happen, those ideas have to be put into language ordinary people can understand and accept. Some have understood this, and they sell Buddhism as life philosophy. It should be explained that way. But if this information could be taught in the seminaries, it might start to impact the various preachers 10 or 20 years down the road. This is the angle I'm working. If the preachers are inwardly Buddhist in their hearts, then you don't need to beat your head against the wall dealing with the ignorant congregants.
When people asked Jesus, what are the signs of the end, the first thing he said was, watch out that no one deceives you. And when the Apostle Paul said goodbye to the elders at Ephesus, he said, watch out. Savage wolves will come in, and even people from your own number will rise up and distort the truth. And then he says, remember, I never stop warning you day and night for 3 years with tears. Is that overkill, or did Paul know what he was dealing with? We have just a few minutes for questions, and we will hang around for a while afterwards if anybody wants to talk. But I strongly recommend that you email us and ask for the quiz, because it will help you Google search some key terms and names and kind of do your own research that took us much longer to do. We'll give you the quick course to do that.
I read Teresa of Avila, when I worked at a Catholic school, I said, what's a good book? And they recommended her Interior Castle. And and I've read some of her other books, and you read some of it, it bored me after a while. But there are things in there, things like the noises in my head are so loud, I don't know what's going on. And her speaking of, you know, you think she developed this interior labyrinth in her brain, and she went in close, you know, farther and farther until when she got to the center of the mental labyrinth, she achieved union with God. But she said, you would think when you, the closer you got, the more secure of your salvation you would feel. But she said, no, you are more concerned about making any little misstep. So even though that was probably the recommended book to me, I found it, number one, boring and kind of tragic.
I'm looking at a conservative Christian magazine that lumped Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, the same theology, and referred to these people as a lush rainforest of spiritual giants. And again, we feel sympathy for where they ended up, but this is no place to get spiritual teaching.
All yoga, the goal of yoga I have read is to work up until you get to Kundalini yoga, which is serpent power. And the idea is that the god Shakti resides at the base of your spine, and you, in your meditation, same kind of sit in silence for 20 minutes, all that, that she will uncoil. Kundalini means coiled. And when she gets to
your crown
chakra, Shakti and Shiva consummate, and it's like an orgasm in your brain. But people who have practiced that then said there are terrible side effects. You can get on websites, Kundalini warnings, feeling like animals or insects are crawling around inside you. And
yeah, but she's saying she's not going to get sucked into that.
Well, a quote from Hinduism Today magazine. This is the best quote. Hinduism Today magazine said, an army of yoga missionaries has been set up on the West. They do not call themselves Hindu, but they know where yoga comes from and where it goes.
If you're not an expert in Hinduism, you don't know. There's no reason to help the cause of yoga and to use the terminology, the namaste greeting, and some of the words, some of the gestures are worship poses. This is where it comes from. Just exercise. And it gives people in the community the wrong idea. If we tell them they're doing yoga, they may find an even darker thing. So it's all about trajectory. If you follow something going in the wrong direction and take people with you,
and
you can't do that.
This again is yoga in the West and yoga in the East. In the West, the blonde wearing spandex, you know, with music in the background. In the East, it's some emaciated old guy wearing the ashes of a corpse. That's where it comes from. And where did Zen Buddhism come from? From a man named Bodhidharma, who lived hundreds of years ago, who meditated in front of a wall for 3 years and then got whacked on the head and attained enlightenment. I'm not making this up. That's where it comes from. And you also might, if you're interested in Zen, you might want to read Zen at War. Can't think of the author's name, but he talks about Soto Zen or Dark Zen, which is mystical Zen. Two words, Pearl Harbor and the Rape of Nanking, China. Those were Zen-trained warriors. They were emptied of themselves and total devotion to the emperor. The common thread in mysticism is emptying yourself. And I've always wondered and read in the book of Revelation, how is it going to happen that the whole world will go after the Antichrist, the beast? How can Muslims and Jews and all these religions? Well, if you follow the mystical segment like Thomas Merton did,
get rid of the doctrine
and go to the experience when you're in an altered state of consciousness, you're in a very highly suggestible state, then in my chart, I ended up at the bottom, mysticism. That's what it is, an emptied state.
The medieval nuns, like Teresa of Avila, who had these supernatural sexual experiences, and they thought it was Jesus. But, I mean, even the PBS special about alien invasion, where people think aliens have bothered them sexually, they said, you know, this is the same kind of thing.
Thinking of Teresa of Avila and Catherine of Siena and the doctors of the church, they became self-abusive, anorexic. I think it was Teresa's final words that said, you know, here is my body, Lord. May it be an anvil for your beatings to atone for sin. Mm-hmm. Sounds like Tibetan Buddhism. No grace.
Mm-hmm. If you realize the theology from Rome that people do pay for part of their sins, Jesus' blood does not cover all sins. So then you get into this ritualistic suffering, and that's where all this teaching of the disciplines is coming from. It's partly the idea that you are atoning, but that's worse. You're doing things to earn merit in the same way the Buddhists earn merit.